The following audio was originally recorded live and broadcast through the facilities of Trent Radio on December 6th, 2019.
As always, I'm Justin Evangelo. This is Disenabled, the show where we enable people with physical disabilities. So happy to be back today. There wasn't a schedule mix-up, thank God. Ann Lands, retired vision teacher, has graciously come in today to do what I consider to be the latter half of the interview. And she's adjusting her mic, so watch your ears. She's in here today to talk more about the academic side of things and her career as a teacher. So right off the bat, you've already talked about your previous education in order to become a vision teacher or teacher of the blind, but we won't use that because I know the blind. We talked about that in a couple previous episodes. It's a label that needs to be rid of. So right off the bat, coming into a classroom on your first day or whenever you first came into a classroom, how were you perceived by the actual teacher of the course when you were going in to assist a student with visual impairment?
Well, that generally depends on the teacher and how confident they are in, and if they've had any experience in teaching somebody who hasn't, who doesn't have vision. Most teachers are not prepared for that and are usually very happy to see you or someone who has some knowledge and what to do, because they're just left standing there. They've been told they have to teach a student, and they have no idea. So usually they're very happy to see you, and it's a matter of your calming them down and telling them it's going to be okay. You know, this is all set up. It won't be a problem. There's just a few little adjustments, i.e. you need to have your planning done about a week ahead of time. That's one of the biggest things. And a lot of teachers don't always have their planning done a week ahead of time. So that's one of the adjustments they have to make. But most of them are very, very good about it. Some maybe aren't. Well,
there's always some, you get a cast of characters wherever you go. Does that differ, do you find, and as the grades go higher and a student transitions into high school, obviously you have more people to track down, more teachers to talk to. Does the attitude shift from an elementary school teacher to a high school teacher in terms of readying the material, approaching the student who has a visual impairment and working successfully with them?
I think it's more what they're teaching, I think. For instance, if they're teaching literacy, that is not so visual. It's a lot of it's just that text work. The student is probably proficient in reading using whatever medium, whether it's Braille or audio or whatever medium they're using. And they can, there's just more talking, they can advocate a little better. When you get the subjects such as mathematics or science, they're usually at a complete loss of how they're going to teach it and what they're going to do and how it's going to work. So I find that's the biggest thing. I've never, ever had a problem with a math teacher or a science teacher.
Well, you also love those subjects as well, so... So
that's
have a vested
natural.
Interest,
it's a
right?
natural fit, mm-hmm. But a lot of times, with what people don't understand when they're teaching literacy, is that a lot of our literacy deals with sight, and that a student, somebody who has never had sight, may not know a lot of the visual contacts. Even print itself is visual compared to Braille, which is just the same dot over and over. It doesn't change. They're not big dots and little dots and that sort of thing. But print, they have bold, they have italics, they have all these this meaning just even within the text that can't be done in Braille, basically. So people don't realize it is very different. They don't realize there's so many, there's so much imagery that's visual that a student who has never seen might not get. And let's go back to our book on pigs. What was that?
The Lord of the Flies.
And this comes up every year when we do this story. The plane crashes, and when it hits these trees, and it makes a scar down the face of the mountain. For somebody who's never seen, they don't visualize that. That may not be something they understand. And teachers don't understand that they don't understand that.
Well, obviously.
So when I'm trying to explain this, it's sometimes the literacy teachers that get a little perturbed. Or history's another one. If you've never had sight at all, you don't have any sight, you don't see aging. You never see the aging process. People don't understand when they're visually impaired, this aging. They don't see their pets grow old. They don't see their parents change visually or their grandparents. They don't see aging. So history, in a way, is a very difficult subject to comprehend. So again, a lot of it's subject material, too.
Going between, say, elementary, where there's rudimentary understanding of the subject matter, and then getting a little bit more specialized with people who have a little bit more specialized degrees in high school, do you find that there's a point of a sort of pride? Like, how would you say that someone, like a high school teacher, because they're teaching a specific subject or two in a similar field, is there a point of pride to say, well, I know how to teach this, you know, who are you to come in and say that they may not understand this?
Well, that's where you're walking a delicate balance there. Yes, a lot of teachers, they have their way of doing things that they've done for many years and it's been successful, and they don't want to maybe change up, or they don't understand how that might suit most of the students in the class, but it might not suit a particular student. But there's always compromise, and it's a matter of if they don't want to change, then I will say, well, can I do it this way, or can we do this instead? So there's always compromises, and I think as a teacher of students with visual impairments, you need to be able to find those compromises. You need to bring out the teacher. What does the teacher want? In all courses, it's what do you want the student to learn? Okay, they can't learn it that way, but could we do it this way?
Right.
So you're a kind of, what are you? What's the word I'm looking for, Justin? Well, you're the literacy person.
You're sort of a go-between. There has to be some sort of economic tact. You have to be a little bit of a politician, at least from what I've seen.
Yeah, you
right?
do. Oh, you do, because you're between administration, teachers, educational assistants, the student, and the parents. So you're the one.
Yeah, you're the go-between.
You're the go-between for all of those, and yet you're also the one, and medicine and medical too, but you're also the one that has knowledge of all this. So you're the one that's juggling all this.
And to that point, one of your responsibilities or duties as a teacher for the visually impaired is teaching advocacy. So when you first come in with a student, provided you start fairly young with them, what does the process look like for encouraging them, teaching them how to advocate for themselves? Is it a case-by-case basis where it's super easy for one student and then not so easy the next because they don't understand or they're scared? What does that look like?
Well, young students, quite young students, don't know what they don't see.
Right.
So with everybody, I find that the easiest way is to model. So classroom teachers watch what I do with the student, and that's how they learn, rather than me trying to tell people what to do. It's usually modeling. So I'll model behavior. I'll model how I talk to them. I'll model language. If you're looking for your notebooks, or whatever. If you're looking for your computer, it's on your desk at the top right-hand corner. You're very specific. Well, classroom teachers will watch that and begin to pick that up. The student themselves will start to go, okay, I need to be specific when I'm looking for something or where I put it. So modeling is generally the easiest way to kind of help everybody. And then they pick up on that. And as a student gets older, you can be a little more specific. Like if we're in high school, it's, okay, you need to go and talk to your teacher and you need to be specifically ask them what you need to do. And if they say, well, you need to do this, and you, that's something that's visual. For instance, doing research on a computer and you can't access their what they've given you because it's not accessible on your computer or with your programs, you need to explain that to them. So again, you teach the student when they're older how to do it. And then if there's trouble, then you go in and liaison
with
the teacher. If you're still not getting anywhere, then you go in and you explain it again.
So obviously, how do you, I don't want to speak for you here. So how do you want the student to perceive you as someone who's there to help, as someone who's there to teach? Like, do you actually have a mindset going in as to, okay, I want the student that I'm assisting with the visual impairment to perceive me or to know me as this person who is capable of doing this and who wants them to learn X, Y, Z?
The only thing I want is for the student to succeed.
Okay.
One thing with visual impairments is that we have two curriculums. We have the academic curriculum, but we also have the extended curriculum, which is the academic what is what we know. That's the curriculum in the school, whatever grade you're in. The extended curriculum is things like teaching Braille, if that's required. It'll be teaching reading and writing in using Braille, if that's required. It'll be teaching computers, the special programs, because nobody else in the board deals with those programs. So you're left teaching how to use your computer. There's things like orientation mobility, which is getting around independently safely.
Mm-hmm.
So we need all that. You're liaising with little we, our little kindergarten students. There's getting dressed. There's daily living skills.
Right.
There's social skills. These are all taught through and by a vision teacher. So our curriculum's a little different. So we're perceived a little differently too then.
For sure, yeah.
You know, also one of the big things is as a vision, somebody who's involved and understands what not having sight kind of means as far as getting along in the real world independently, sometimes we're the only person that understands the visually impaired student. And so you are perceived, I think, more as a friend or a mentor, or it's how they perceive me, not so much as how I want to be perceived.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. I just want them to succeed and be able to go out independently in the real world.
Bottom line, obviously, is the success and being a quote-unquote normal, well, not even normal, but functional member of society when all is said and done. Now, that segues perfectly because I wanted to talk to you today about parental perception as well and how some parents have taken to your role in the classroom. I'm sure there's been misunderstandings or not incomplete understandings about what you do in the class and overestimations as to what you can do. So in your experience, what has it been like being, we've talked about the liaison between teacher and student and then, student to teacher. And now what's it like to be that connect between the parent to the child who, you know, the parent's always going to be like, well, I know my child the best, you know, who are you to say X, Y, Z?
Okay. That's an interesting one too, because they do know their child the best. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what disability you are. The first thing I do is say, you know your child the best. I acknowledge that because it's phenomenal they've raised this student to get to this point in time to go to school. And, you know, but there's very few places out in the community where parents actually learn and can learn about visual impairment and vision loss. And I'm kind of the one. So on one hand, they kind of need me. They'll have their own ideas. And what happens is you start very slowly. They learn to trust you. The student learns to trust you. You don't tell them everything all at once. You just say, okay, this is the way it usually works. And once they see success within their student, then they, and it, this evolves over time, of course, then, you know, they rely more and more on you. I've had, introducing white canes is often a very difficult step for parents, and a lot of them will say, no, we're not going to do that, until they understand what the cane means, what it's going to mean to the student. And it's usually the student that says, no, I want to use it, because I am then more independent. So, again, it's, like I said, it's more of a long-term thing. It's not like going in and having one teacher in one grade.
Right.
You kind of follow the student, and by then you do gradually build up. And I'd like to think that I really had good relationships with all my parents.
Yeah.
And, like, sure, they've had times where they're not going to do that or whatever, and then it's okay. We find, again, it's finding compromise. It's finding, okay, as long as you understand, it's the same thing with the student as with the parent. As long as you understand why I'm, say, asking that or going for that or suggesting that, as long as they understand it, if they still don't want to do it, that's fine.
Oh, for sure. And
we'll find something else.
Yeah, that circles back to being diplomatic, right?
You have to. Diplomatic. That's the word we were looking for.
There we go. We found it. And circling back to that, if the parents see, let's circle back to the white cane introduction. When the parent sees that the child is so hungry, let's just say, or avidly wants it so they can be independent, does that usually change their tune? Because, I mean, what would be the main reason why a parent wouldn't want their child to, say, use a cane or any sort of device that would help them navigate in the real world?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. One of them's safety. They might perceive that you're more vulnerable because people notice you don't see. Another one is the independence, that, again, safety again in a different way, in that you're now out on the street.
Right.
You know, you can get hit by a car.
Yeah.
I mean, all parents obviously are worried about things like that. Because they don't understand how you travel and how we travel safely when we don't see, parents will just say no. Another one might be guilt. Another one might be they want to keep them as babies. They want to keep them in there because they feel they're keeping them safe. So there's a lot of reasons why parents don't want something like that, or it's a stigma. Oh, heaven forbids, people will know that my child is blind.
Yeah.
Well, they do anyways, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But it's something the child, remember, is learning and growing all the time. So the child is adjusted. Sometimes the parents don't adjust as quickly as the child because they're not having to live it.
Right. And
again, I think it's just time. It takes time.
It does.
And sometimes I can't explain it enough, but every time, once the students are ready, it's they end up getting their way. You can't hold them
right,
back.
Right. Well, and even if you try, they'll find ways to circumnavigate that, and whether it be through rebellion, that's healthy or not.
Exactly.
Right.
So that's what happens, but then once the parent understands that this is just like any other child, and that they can take care of themselves, it's usually they probably wonder why they put up such a fuss.
It's like, oh man, always hindsight, no pun intended, 2020, and looking back and being reflective, it's like, huh, I wonder why I ever fretted about that. Okay.
Exactly. Like letting your child start driving.
Yeah.
Every parent goes through this. This is just a different form.
Yeah, it takes a different shape and a different size. Final point I wanted to touch on then, and maybe you can speak to this or maybe you can't. In your professional career, has there ever been a situation where you've had to, let's not say manage, but mediate conversations between a parent and the teacher of a specific class, course, what have you, because there's some sort of disconnect, say that the student with the disability is struggling and the parents are saying, well, why aren't you doing this? And the teacher's flustered and saying, well, what do you want me to do? Has there ever been a situation where you've come in and there's been high tensions between those two authority figures.
Not so much with teachers. Usually you kind of, once they have the student in their class for a while, they begin to realize what you've been saying or modeling for them. And then, oh, yeah, okay, it twigs in because they're actually dealing with the student. Sometimes it's more with the parents and administration where the parents are thinking maybe the school administration isn't giving their student, their child, enough, or they're asking too much of their child, or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it would be more inclined to be that area. And again, hopefully you head that off at the pass before it ever becomes a problem. But there has been one or two cases where the board, such as maybe the superintendent of the school in Spec Ed or something like that, needs to sit down with the parents. And, of course, you're there, again, as the middle liaison person. And I'm the student, too.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Do you find, like, when a situation like that arises, is it usually rooted in ignorance, misunderstanding? Like, what would cause a situation like that to come about?
Again, parents don't really have too many places to go to really learn about vision and where to go. So they're kind of relying on other professionals. And that's hard for people. That's quite difficult for people. As you said before, they know their child the best, but they don't always know what's best for their child.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And as I said, the child learns through school, and the child gets the time to learn and grow and develop and understand, and the parent doesn't necessarily. And I've always encouraged parents, come in and talk to me, come in and talk to me. But some parents maybe can't or don't.
Right.
And then it builds up, and until, you know, you hit that point. But again, if you can get the child and the parent and everybody together, often that sorts it out.
For sure, because then they have the opportunity in the space.
Because often the child speaks up.
Yeah, they don't even need to be, taught advocacy. It's like, hey, I want to,
they know what they can do. Sometimes the parents don't even understand what their own child can do.
Right.
And they want to, and they're holding them back inadvertently. They don't mean
to. No, they don't mean to.
But they're holding them back. And sometimes the child just has to stand up and say, I can do this. And that's usually what it takes. It's not usually me. It's me getting everybody together.
Right.
And then the student speaks up.
So the moral of the story is, two here. Don't underestimate the capability of the student.
Or someone with
a physical disability of any description. And when in doubt, just ask. Because a lot of these, again, it always circles back. I can't believe I'm 10 episodes deep and...
we're still going back to the same.
We're still going to the same. It's the same roads. Anne Lands, everybody, thank you so much for taking the time to navigate these amazing roads on this snowy Friday to briefly talk about your professions, and I can't wait to actually edit this and actually turn it into one big long interview. It should be fun. So thank you so much for coming in almost back-to-back times and educating any listeners who may not know and who can take something away from what's been talked about here.
Another one from the archives in the books, cliche statement, I know. If you were able to and you stuck around to the end of the episode, thank you. I hope you found the content enjoyable and educational simultaneously, one or the other. Send me some feedback. As always, you can hit me up, drop me a line at disenabled.podcast@gmail.com. That email linked in the episode's description. Great way to connect with me. Another great way to support me is to subscribe to the podcast, rate it, share it, and obviously to give it a review on your preferred listening platform of choice. I'm on about 6 or 7 now, thanks to Maxwell Ivy Jr., who also goes by the Blind Blogger, putting me on his disability-based podcasting network, What's Your Excuse? I will link him once again in the show notes. Check that podcasting network out, and I will leave a link to the previous conversation in the last episode I had with Ann Lands as well. Hope you enjoyed, folks. With the self-promotion out of the way, until next time, cheers.